Fightful.com. Famous Men of the Middle Ages, Part 9. William Tell and Arnold von Winkelried. Far up among the Alps, in the very heart of Switzerland, are three districts, or cantons, as they are called, which are known as the Forest Cantons, and are famous in the world's history. About 2,000 years ago, the Romans found in these cantons a hardy race of mountaineers who, although poor, were free men and proud of their independence. They became the friends and allies of Rome, and the cantons were for many years a part of the Roman Empire, but the people always had the right to elect their own officers and to govern themselves. When Goths and the Vandals and the Huns from beyond the Rhine and the Danube overran the Roman Empire, these three cantons were not disturbed. The land was too poor and rocky to attract men who were fighting for possession of the rich plains and valleys of Europe, and so it happened that for century after century, the mountaineers of these cantons lived on in their old, simple ways, undisturbed by the rest of the world. In a canton in the valley of the Rhine lived the Habsburg family, whose leaders in time grew to be very rich and powerful. They became dukes of Austria, and some of them were elected emperors. One of the Habsburgs, Albert I, claimed that the land of the Forest Cantons belonged to him. He sent a governor and a band of soldiers to those cantons and made the people submit to his authority. In one of the Forest Cantons at this time lived a famous mountaineer named William Tell. He was tall and strong. In all Switzerland, no man had a foot so sure as his on the mountains, or a hand so skilled in the use of a bow. He was determined to resist the Austrians. Secret meetings of the mountaineers were held, and all took a solemn oath to stand by each other and fight for their freedom. But they had no arms, and were simple shepherds who had never been trained as soldiers. The first thing to be done was to get arms without attracting the attention of the Austrians. It took nearly a year to secure spears, swords, and battle axes and distribute them among the mountaineers. Finally, this was done, and everything was ready. All were waiting for a signal to rise. The story tells us that just at this time, Gessler, the Austrian governor, who was a cruel tyrant, hung a cap on a high pole in the marketplace in the village of Altorf and forced everyone who passed to bow before it. Tell, accompanied by his little son, happened to pass through the marketplace. He refused to bow before the cap and was arrested. Gessler offered to release him if he would shoot an apple from the head of his son. The governor hated Tell and made this offer, hoping that the mountaineer's hand would tremble and that he would kill his own son. It is said that Tell shot the apple from his son's head, but that Gessler still refused to release him. That night, as Tell was being carried across the lake to prison, a storm came up. In the midst of the storm, he sprang from the boat to an overhanging rock and made his escape. It is said that he killed the tyrant. Some people do not believe this story, but the Swiss do, and if you go to Lake Lucerne some day, they will show you the very rock upon which Tell stepped when he sprang from the boat. That night, the signal fires were lit on every mountain, and by the dawn of day, the village of Altorf was filled with hardy mountaineers, armed and ready to fight for their liberty. A battle followed, and the Austrians were defeated and driven from Altorf. Their victory was followed by others. A few years later, the Duke himself came with a large army, determined to conquer the mountaineers. He had to march through a narrow pass, with mountains rising abruptly on either side. The Swiss were expecting him, and hid along the heights above the pass. As soon as the Austrians appeared in the pass, rocks and trunks of trees were hurled down upon them. Many were killed and wounded. Their army was defeated, and the Duke was forced to recognize the independence of the Forest Cantons. This was the beginning of the Republic of Switzerland. In time, five other cantons joined them in a compact for liberty. About 70 years later, the Austrians made another attempt to conquer the Patriots. They collected a splendid army and marched into the mountains. The Swiss at once armed themselves and met the Austrians at a place called Sempach. In those times, powder had not been invented, and men fought with spears, swords, and battle axes. The Austrian soldiers stood shoulder to shoulder, each grasping a long spear, whose point projected far in front of him. The Swiss were armed with short swords and spears, and it was impossible for them to get to the Austrians. For a while, their cause looked hopeless, but among the ranks of the Swiss was a brave man from one of the forest cantons. His name was Arnold von Winkelried. As he looked upon the bristling points of the Austrian spears, he saw that his comrades had no chance to win unless an opening could be made in that line. He determined to make such an opening, even at the cost of his life. Extending his arms as far as he could, he rushed towards the Austrian line and gathered within his arms as many spears as he could grasp. "Make way for liberty!" he cried, then ran with arms extended wide. As if his dearest friend to clasp, 10 spears he swept within his grasp. "Make way for liberty!" he cried. Their keen points met from side to side. He bowed among them like a tree, and thus made way for liberty. Pierced through and through, Winkelried fell dead, but he had made a gap in the Austrian line, and into this gap rushed the Swiss patriots. Victory was theirs, and the cantons were free.
You're tuned in to Radio Aryan.
Henry V, king from 1413 to 1422 AD. Of all the kings that England ever had, Henry V was perhaps the greatest favourite among the people. They liked him because he was handsome and brave, and above all, because he conquered France. In his youth, Prince Hal, as the people called him, had a number of merry companions who sometimes got themselves into trouble with their pranks. Once, one of them was arrested and brought before the Chief Justice of the kingdom. Prince Hal was not pleased because sentence was given against his companion, and he drew his sword, threatening the judge. Upon this, the judge bravely ordered the prince to be arrested and put into prison. Prince Hal submitted to his punishment with good grace, and his father is reported to have said, "Happy is the monarch who has so just a judge, and a son so willing to obey the law." One of Prince Hal's companions was a fat old knight named Sir John Falstaff. Once, Falstaff was boasting that he and 3 men had beaten and almost killed 2 men in buckram suits who had attacked and tried to rob them. The prince led him on and gave him a chance to brag as much as he wanted to, until finally Falstaff swore that there were at least 100 robbers and that he himself fought with 50. Then Prince Hal told their companions that only two men had attacked Falstaff and his friends, and that he and another man who was present were those two. And he said that Falstaff, instead of fighting, had run as fast as his legs could carry him. There was real goodness, as well as merriment, in Prince Hal, and so the people found, for when he became king on the death of his father, he told his wild companions that the days of his wildness were over, and he advised them to lead better lives in future. As Henry V, Prince Hal made himself famous in English history by his war with France. Normandy, you will remember, had belonged to Henry's ancestor, William the Conqueror. It had been taken from King John of England by the French king, Philip Augustus, in 1203. Soon after his coronation, Henry sent a demand to the French king that Normandy should be restored, and he made the claim which his great-grandfather Edward III had made, that he was by right the King of France. Of course, the King of France would not acknowledge this. Henry therefore raised an army of 30,000 men and invaded France. Before he began to attack the French, he gave strict orders to his men that they were to harm no one who was not a soldier, and to take nothing from the houses or farms of any persons who were not fighting. Sickness broke out among Henry's troops after they landed, so that their number was reduced to about 15,000. 50,000 or 60,000 Frenchmen were encamped on the field of Agincourt to oppose this little army. The odds were greatly against Henry. The night before the battle, one of his officers said he wished that the many thousand brave soldiers who were quietly sleeping in their beds in England were with the king. "I would not have a single man more," said Henry. "If God gives us victory, it will be plain that we owe it to his grace. If not, the fewer we are, the less loss for England." The men drew courage from their king. The English archers poured arrows into the ranks of their opponents, and although the French fought bravely, they were completely routed. 11,000 Frenchmen fell. Among the slain were more than 100 of the nobles of the land. Agincourt was not the last of Henry's victories. He brought a second army of 40,000 men over to France. Town after town was captured, and at last Henry and his victorious troops laid siege to Rouen, which was then the largest and richest city in France. The fortifications were so strong that Henry could not storm them, so he determined to take the place by starving the garrison. He said, "War has three handmaidens, fire, blood, and famine. I have chosen the meekest of the three." He had trenches dug around the town and placed soldiers in them to prevent the citizens from going out of the city for supplies and to prevent the country people from taking provisions in. A great number of the country people had left their homes when they heard that the English army was marching towards Rouen and had taken refuge within the city walls. After the siege had gone on for 6 months, there was so little food left in the place that the commander of the garrison ordered these poor people to go back to their homes. 12,000 were put outside the gates, but Henry would not allow them to pass through his lines, so they starved to death between the walls of the French and the trenches of the English. As winter came on, the suffering of the citizens was terrible. At last, they determined to set fire to the city, open their gates, and make a last desperate attack on the English. Henry wished to preserve the city, and offered such generous terms of surrender that the people accepted them. Not only Rouen, but the whole of Normandy, which the French had held for 200 years, was now forced to submit to Henry. The war continued for about 2 years more, and the English gained possession of such a large part of France that at Christmas Henry entered Paris itself in triumph. But, strange to say, the king, against whom he had been fighting, and over whom he was triumphing, sat by his side as he rode through the streets. What did this mean? It meant that the French were so terrified by the many victories of Henry that all, king and people, were willing to give him whatever he asked. A treaty was made that as the king was feeble, Henry should be regent of the kingdom, and that when the king died, Henry should succeed him as the king of France. In the treaty, the French king also agreed to give to Henry his daughter, the Princess Catherine, in marriage. She became the mother of another English king, Henry VI. The arrangement that an English sovereign should be King of France was never put into effect, for in less than 2 years after the treaty was signed, the reign of the great conqueror came to an end. Henry died. In the reign of his son, all his work in gaining French territory was undone. By the time that Henry VI was 20 years old, England, as you will hear in the story of Joan of Arc, had nothing left of all that had been won by so many years of war, except for the single town of Calais.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Joan of Arc, who lived from 1412 to 1431 AD. In the long wars between the French and the English, not even the Black Prince or Henry V gained such fame as did a young French peasant girl, Joan of Arc. She was born in the little village of Domremy. Her father had often told her of the sad condition of France, how the country was largely in the possession of England, and how the French king did not dare to be crowned. And so the thought came to be ever in her mind, how I pity my country. She brooded over the matter so much that by and by she began to have visions of angels and heard strange voices which said to her, "Joan, you can deliver the land from the English. Go to the relief of King Charles." At last, these strange visions and voices made the young girl believe that she had a mission from God, and she determined to try and save France. And when she told her father and mother of her purpose, they tried to persuade her that the visions of angels and the voices telling her of the divine mission were but dreams. "I tell thee, Joan," said her father, "it is thy fancy. Thou hadst better have a kind husband to take care of thee, and do some work to employ thy mind." "Father, I must do what God has willed, for this is no work of my choosing," she replied. "Mother, I would far rather sit and spin by your side than take part in war. My mission is no dream. I know that I have been chosen by the Lord to fulfill his purpose, and nothing can prevent me from going where he purposes to send me." The village priest, her young companions, even the governor of the town, all tried to stop her, but it was in vain. To the governor she said, "I must do the work my Lord has laid out for me." Little by little, people began to believe in her mission. At last, all stopped trying to discourage her, and some who were wealthy helped her to make the journey to the town of Chinon, where the French king, Charles VII, was living. When Joan arrived at Chinon, a force of French soldiers was preparing to go to the south of France to relieve the city of Orleans, which the English were besieging. King Charles received Joan kindly and listened to what she had to say with deep attention. The girl spoke modestly, but with a calm belief that she was right. "Gracious King," she said, "my name is Joan. God has sent me to deliver France from her enemies. You shall shortly be crowned in the Cathedral of Reims. I am to lead the soldiers you are about to send for the relief of Orleans. So God has directed, and under my guidance, victory will be theirs." The king and his nobles talked the matter over, and finally it was decided to allow Joan to lead an army of about 5,000 men against the English at Orleans. When she left Chinon at the head of her soldiers in April 1429, she was in her 18th year. Mounted on a fine warhorse and clad in white armour from head to foot, she rode along past the cheering multitudes, seeming rather, it has been said, of heaven than of earth. In one hand she carried an ancient sword that she had found near the tomb of a saint, and in the other a white banner embroidered with lilies. The rough soldiers who were near her left off their oaths and coarse manners and carefully guarded her. She inspired the whole army with courage and faith as she talked about her visions. When she arrived at the besieged city of Orleans, she fearlessly rode around its walls, while the English soldiers looked on in astonishment. She was able to enter Orleans despite the efforts of the besiegers to prevent her. She aroused the city by her cheerful, confident words, and then led her soldiers forth to give battle to the English. Their success was amazing. One after another, the English forts were taken. When only the strongest remained, and Joan was leading the attacking force, she received a slight wound and was carried out of the battle to be attended to by a surgeon. Her soldiers began to retreat. "Wait," she commanded, "eat, drink, and rest, for as soon as I recover, I will touch the walls with my banner, and you shall enter the fort." In a few minutes, she mounted her horse again, and riding rapidly up to the fort, touched it with her banner. Her soldiers almost instantly carried it. The very next day, the enemy's troops were forced to withdraw from before the city, and the siege was at an end. The French soldiers were jubilant at the victory, and called Joan the Maid of Orleans. By this name, she is known in history. Her fame spread everywhere, and the English as well as the French thought that she had more than human power. She led the French in several other battles, and again her troops were victorious. At last, the English were driven far to the north of France. Then Charles, urged by Joan, went to Reims with 12,000 soldiers, and there, with splendid ceremony, was crowned king. Joan, holding forth her white banner, stood near Charles during the coronation. When the ceremony was finished, she knelt at his feet and said, "O King, the will of God is done, and my mission is over. Let me now go home to my parents." But the king urged her to stay a while longer, as France was not entirely freed from the English. Joan consented, but she said, "I hear the heavenly voices no more, and I am afraid." However, she took part in an attack upon the army of the Duke of Burgundy, but was taken prisoner by him. For a large sum of money, the Duke delivered her into the hands of the English, who put her in prison in Rouen. She lay in prison for a year, and finally was charged with sorcery and brought to trial. It was said that she was under the influence of the Evil One. She declared to her judges her innocence of the charge and said, "God has always been my guide in all that I have done. The devil has never had any power over me." Her trial was long and tiresome. At its close, she was doomed to be burned at the stake. So in the marketplace at Rouen, the English soldiers fastened her to a stake, surrounded by a great pile of faggots. A soldier put into her hands a rough cross, which he had made from a stick that he held. She thanked him and pressed it to her bosom. Then a good priest, standing near the stake, read to her the prayers for the dying, and another mounted the faggots and held towards her a crucifix, which she clasped with both hands and kissed. When the cruel flames burst out around her, the noble girl uttered the word Jesus and expired. A statue of her now stands on the very spot where she suffered. Among all the men of her time, none did nobler work than Joan, and hence it is that we put the story of her life among the stories of the lives of the great men of the Middle Ages, although she was only a simple peasant girl.
You're listening to Radio Arian at RadioArian.com.